there have been moments in my life where, you know, I found myself in a situation, and these situations are rare. I said, gosh, I would really benefit from having a hatchet right now. Ironically, though, there are other situations, and these are much more frequent, where I'm really happy that I'm not holding a hatchet, because I fear that I would use said hatchet to destroy the monitor on which I am watching a YouTube video that I'm planning to use for show prep. And today I want to share one of these experiences with you. This video is called The Right to Say Forum, Freedom, Respect, and Campus Speech. It was held at NYU last spring. The participants were Jonathan Haidt, whose name, unfortunately, you will hear me mispronounce several times in today's show, and Vivian Bonilla Lopez, a graduate student at the NYU School of Law, meaning like when she's done, she's one step closer to becoming a lawyer, which, as you're about to learn, is quite terrifying. There's a couple other participants as well, but I want to focus here on exchanges between Haidt and Lopez. The issue of debate in this forum is the need in college classes for what used to be called trigger warnings, but have now been rebranded as content warnings. And this is a good sign, these rebrandings. It's a sign that some of the terminology of the social justice left has been so ridiculed that they're actually having to rename things, because even just saying their old terminology now makes people laugh. So trigger warnings are now called content warnings. And these are not content warnings that are given in a syllabus for a class at the beginning of a semester. This is a call for a real-time obligation of the college professor to stop teaching and say, okay, next we are going to talk about this. So I need to let you know that just in case you have ever experienced this, 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 or this. Now, a lot of times these issues are reduced to, okay, which side are you on? Are you a snowflake or are you somebody who wants to melt the snowflakes? But from watching this presentation, you will learn that there is a lot more nuance than that. All of the other participants in this forum, in fact, prove that you don't have to be one of these close-minded, oppressive, hardcore snowflake melters to disagree with the snowflake types and have good reasons for disagreeing with them, while maintaining the needs of students as a top priority. And even after watching this whole presentation, which is about an hour and 15 minutes, I didn't really get a sense of the application of this in the college classroom. Like, who's served by these trigger warnings? You know, like, okay, everybody, next we're going to talk about sexual assault. So if you're a victim of sexual assault, this would be a good time to leave. And, you know, everybody else just try not to pay too much attention to the people who are getting up and leaving the classroom because they were victims of sexual assault. I don't know how this actually works in practice. Even after watching this, I don't know what the warning, and Jonathan Haidt would agree with me based on his contributions, what the benefit of having the warning ahead of time really is. And there's certainly no benefits from, you know, overprotecting people against slightly traumatic things just because it reminds them of something more traumatic from their past, or just because it triggers them in a certain way. The most important thing that I learned from this forum, and I'm going to play you a clip of it, is that the people advocating trigger warnings don't care. When you really listen to their arguments, you kind of have to conclude that the real driving force behind a lot of these demands, I'm not saying it's the only force, I'm saying it's the driving force, seems to be this impulse, this desire to look at something as it is and make it into something else, to have their impact felt, to make a change to a person's behavior or institutional policies that impact other people negatively or cause other people inconveniences, especially if those people can be portrayed as holding higher positions of power or privilege, as long as they can put the thinnest veneer of progress over their new proposed policy. They do not care what the outcome is. They do not care if it actually helps people or not, because if their change is made and no positive benefits are realized, they can revert to blaming the exact same oppressive forces that they targeted to bring about their original policy change. We established trigger warnings. It didn't make a difference. It didn't make a positive psychological impact on the people we set out to help. So, oh wow, what we've realized is the institutional oppression is deeper than we even thought it was. And that way, the long march of our ideas through the institution continues. And it doesn't matter what the impact is on the people we claim to help. The negative effects this has on their sense of self-advocacy or self-assertiveness or their own sense of personal responsibility. The goal isn't to make strong people, because where strong people exist, the march can't continue. Today on the show, I'm going to offer some theories about where I think the impulses of people like Viviana Bonilla Lopez actually come from, in a way that helped me, and I hope will help you, fight my own shortcut thinking to view Viviana the person as the actual problem here. And this is one of the shortcuts in warring against the social justice warriors. There needs to be a very clear but of the joke, right? It needs to be a person, something, something, puff. It's very easy to direct this attack when you hear her speak, right? It's very easy to direct this attack and even have this kind of resentment. If you listen to this show and you're on board with our message, then yeah, you probably want to live in a world where there's greater psychological health, where people are better educated, where people can communicate with each other in ways that are more connected. And it's very easy, I think, to get angry at somebody like this saying, hey, you're ruining it for the rest of us with your stupid shit. But Viviana Bonilla Lopez's don't just appear. But just as an exercise, let's start with a couple excerpts from this forum, and we'll see how you feel.
So I think particularly when we're talking about being in the classroom and making sure that this is a safe environment for all students, one thing that comes up really often is this idea of content warnings. And the reason that I like bringing up the Americans with Disabilities Act is that, to me, content warnings are all about access. So I think of them as sort of collective reasonable accommodations. If you think about the purpose of the Americans with Disabilities Act, it is to make sure that people with disabilities have the same ability to participate and access to the same things that people who don't have disabilities do. And that's sort of the same idea behind content warnings. If you think about the way our society is organized, it's in an ableist way. It's to privilege people without disabilities, people who don't need these kinds of accommodations. And that's sort of an arbitrary choice. Like, why did we decide to organize our society that way? If we think about things like sidewalks, for example, like, why are curbs elevated? We've added ramps in order to make sure that people with wheelchairs can access sidewalks. And those benefits all kinds of people, people with their groceries, people with strollers. So content warnings in the classroom, they're really similar. They don't just benefit people who might be triggered or traumatized by content, but also sort of everybody by sort of setting an idea that this will be a safe space for this conversation. It signals to those who might not have those experiences, hey, this is an area where I maybe need to take a second look to be a good ally, to be a good peer. And I think that it's also really important to think about when we say things like, oh, those are inconvenient, or why should I have to do this? Why should I have to change the way that I teach? I feel like we're making people from marginalized communities invisible, and we're pretending that they're not there. Why should we have to wait for someone who has experienced sexual violence to come forward and ask for a content warning when we know that 1 in 4 women in college will go through this? When we refuse to affirmatively do these things, to affirmatively make our classrooms safer for people, we're pretending that people from marginalized communities are invisible and that they're not there. And I think that that's a problem.
Okay. Anybody want to comment on this? Yes, John.
I'd be happy to. So I think it's helpful to take the accommodationist perspective, and we certainly all want people to feel that the classroom is open to them. We don't want people coming to the classroom and being afraid. But first, I would question, is there any evidence or reason to think that giving content warnings or trigger warnings actually will do this? As a psychologist, I've been looking into this, and the more you label things as potentially threatening, the more they develop a certain power to actually threaten. So think about it this way. I teach classes in the business school here. Suppose I took my students on field trips all over New York. But every time we went to the Bronx, I said, now, today, we're going to the Bronx. Just want to let you know, We'll have an ambulance with us. We'll have police protection. But don't worry about it. We're going to the Bronx. And I only do that for the Bronx. What are people going to conclude about the Bronx? Now, if there was evidence that these warnings actually helped people get over PTSD, then we'd have to balance various things. But there isn't. And the therapist that I talked to, the people who study PTSD, were unanimous in saying that if someone has PTSD, the last thing you want to do is shield them from small reminders. In fact, the only way to get over the Pavlovianly conditioned fear is to let them be exposed to small things, and then nothing bad happens to them, and that's how the fear subsides. So I'm totally fine with being really explicit on the syllabus. We're going to cover these things. Of course, let people know before they join. But if in the course of daily teaching you say, we're about to look at something that shows this, that, or the other thing, content warning, you're actually hurting the very people you want to help.
Can I respond to that? So, I mean, first, I don't understand how the warning about the Bronx could be the kind of thing that we're talking about. I actually think that that's probably a really problematic thing to say to your students.
Yeah, it would be.
And I don't think that there's anybody who's been requesting that, that these are the kinds of things that we're talking about. I take issue with this idea that, you know, you're helping students by not giving them a content warning. You know, if you think about this sort of, that's what you're talking about is therapy. It's a treatment that happens in a therapeutic setting, and I don't think that it's like up to a professor to tell someone that what's best for them in their treatment and wherever they are in their development to listen to something.
Can I just ask a question? I mean, the normal model of an accommodation is somebody notifies you that they need an accommodation, they describe it, and if it's a medically required accommodation, then the American Disabilities Act requires you to do something about it. But you're talking about something slightly different, right? You're talking about, as it were, anticipating that there might be a need for an accommodation in every class. Is that right? In every class where any topic that might produce this. Why isn't it a better model just to ask, get people to ask?
Well, I think that we need to shift the burden from people from marginalized communities and forcing them to sort of come forward in the way that we know will stigmatize them, in a way that we know like puts them in harm's way or makes them have to be vulnerable when we already know what their needs are. And this is a situation, is the system is made to benefit people who have privilege in our society. And it's that way because someone made that choice. Why aren't we shifting that? Like, why aren't we questioning that that's the way that it's set up?
Everybody, today is February 23rd. Last week, the end of last week, I sat down for an interview with Drew Sample. He interviewed me for his show, The Sample Hour. You're going to hear a portion of that podcast today. If you want to hear the whole show, it's linked in the show notes. And I recommend you check out Drew's work. It's at samplehour.com. Drew's podcast focuses a lot on urban and small-scale farming, agorism, entrepreneurship. It's a very eclectic show, so there's lots of topics covered there, but those farming topics seem to be an area of focus where Drew has done some very good work, and he's had some very good discussions with people who are making that work. So I know that we have people in the audience interested in those topics, and The Sample Hour is a good resource for that if you're interested. So this was a long discussion. It was almost 2 hours long. And about a third of the way through, Drew said to me, well, what do you think is going on in higher education? And what a big and exciting question that is, right? Now, I've been trying to discipline myself to see the college problem from more angles. It's obviously a confluence of things. So we try to discuss a lot of the troubles we see in the world today, in college and beyond, using this kind of rivers running together metaphor that I'm working on. And I'm trying to there's been a lot of talk on the show recently about the anti-philosophy of postmodernism. And this is something I've been studying pretty intensely over the last couple of weeks. And this is in an attempt to get beyond the low-hanging fruits of the higher education issues, the SJW meltdown compilation style presentation, but also more in depth than like a Frankfurt School conspiracy. And the Frankfurt School is a very real thing, and it did have an impact. And, you know, somebody sent me this terrible Vice article about like, oh, look, here's more from the people who think that reptiles run the world. On some issues, Vice is terrible. I was really surprised by how poorly written this article was. But it's easy to dismiss that as another conspiracy theory. But we can see very real impacts of a larger philosophy on the 21st century world, in politics, in culture, in society, in law. And I think it's something that's really worth digging into, because the more we can make explicit what postmodernism is all about, the better equipped I feel like more of us will be to not only understand our current age and, you know, the confluence of ideas and factors that contribute to it, but also make us more adept in our efforts to communicate these problems to other people in ways that are clear and, you know, not necessarily over emotional or over otherizing. And I think that there's also great payoffs. I'm realizing this for myself in evaluating some aspects of my own thinking, right? So the postmodern worldview. And by the way, just before I go into this, Gardner Goldsmith and I just did a bonus show on this subject. It's called The Many Paths to Milo Gate. I put it out a couple of days ago. It was the day most of this Milo news was breaking or getting the most attention, the day of his press conference. And Gardner and I go into greater detail there. So I highly recommend checking that show out if you can. And I've had to ask myself, you've heard me ask myself this several times dating back to the Speed and Politics series, how much of a postmodern worldview is running in the background of my own thinking? You know, one of the big ideas that Garden and I go into some detail about in that discussion is deconstruction. And deconstruction is a very important feature of the postmodern idea set, because implanting into a young person's head, I'm thinking most of this happening in higher education with very left-leaning, very socialist college professors, especially in the social sciences, implanting a new economic worldview or a new political worldview is going to require some cleaning up of what they see as toxic ideas, the kind of ideas that we assimilate into just by living in the United States, even though these ideas that are considered to be, you know, foundational ideas of the West, there's like, you know, some mixed reviews on how they get practiced in what is considered Western civilization throughout time, and certainly in the 20th century. But things like individualism, capitalism, free markets, and of course, all of these ideas have been eroded as well. But if you're a Marxist, the immersion of young people in a society like America, that is still too much of a threat, right? Their minds are still too polluted for you to just easily insert a new worldview into those minds. The postmodernists see this as a pollution that they need to kind of clean up so they can get to more of a tabula rasa with their students to push the ideas that they want to push. So everything is like very relativistic and subjective when it comes to deconstructing, right? When it comes to undoing. But then these people turn into real absolutists when it comes to their ideas, right? It's an interesting phenomenon. But I went to college and I was exposed to this deconstruction approach. And I emerged from that saying, oh, okay, well, everything that I experienced before college was bullshit. And now all my lefty professors have given me the truth. So now I've been kind of like cleansed, and that puts me in a better position to actually go out and find, you know, a new truth, that from the new truth rises from the ashes of all the old bullshit. And it kind of set me up to take this revolutionary approach to history instead of an evolutionary approach to history. And one of the things that I was talking about and trying to audit a little bit in my own thinking during the Speed and Politics series is how much of this postmodernist program runs in the background of my own thinking. I think a lot of what I'm about to describe could be more emotional impulses as well, but I think this kind of thinking provides a container to shape future thoughts. So you've probably noticed that over the last year, I have begun to be more friendly to or talk more favorably about certain individuals and groups that many of you thought I would probably never show any sympathies towards. And this has upset some people, and I understand that. And one of the things that I think has been happening for me is that the deconstructive impulse is powerful because it's easy, right? So oftentimes we get this shortcut, and we even get an easy chance to connect with other people or project our ideas outward based on what we are against, based on criticism, instead of speaking in the affirmative about our own ideas. So I've had to take extra care not to orient myself and present myself with a focus on what I'm against. Because when I get stuck in that mindset, I wind up with sympathies towards or alliances with, people like Milo, or even people like Donald Trump, if I'm not careful, if I'm not conscious. And why? Because we share many of the same enemies. And at times, for whatever reason, I have chosen to hyper-focus on my enemies. And we're seeing so much of this in the libertarian conversation right now, where people rail against the left, but they also seem to be somewhat infected by this aspect of postmodernism, right? Where what I'm against, what I stand against, what I hope to destroy is more important than what I am actually for. Now, I think to some degree, this is a feature of a natural process in a simpler part of the human brain, right? Be on the lookout for the predators. And I'm not saying it isn't important, but one of the purposes of learning about these things is to present them effectively to others. And it's also, to defend yourself, not just from external threats, but from internal threats as well. We're watching people, especially in higher education, especially on the left, basically destroy themselves with their own thinking. And I'm trying to, live consciously enough where I'm not even occasionally engaging in types of destructive thinking. But shit, I am sometimes. So making the aspects of postmodernism explicit allows me to, as I, process my own thoughts, go, this seems to be one of those suboptimal, non-life-serving mindsets that stuck in my head, perhaps, all the way back in college. Or that's where it was made concrete. Like I said, there's probably some natural aspects to this as well, but it is a big part of postmodern thought. And it's also worth pointing out that the impulses behind things like the methodology of deconstruction or critical theory are, in many cases, good. We're talking about skepticism. We're talking about questioning and challenging authority. We're talking about evaluating the institutions that claim to govern us and who those institutions really serve, and asking whether or not we're, to some degree, haunted by ideas of the past that have never been properly evaluated. The term deconstruction is usually attached to the work of a postmodernist named Jacques Derrida. And he's somebody that we'll probably be talking about on the show in more detail in the near future. So libertarianism, to some extent, that really grew up in the 1970s after a lot of these ideas took over academia in the 1960s, is to some degree, a child of this, and not in its, actual philosophy, which has much, much, much deeper roots, but perhaps in the movement aspect of libertarianism, which in many ways was critical and revolutionary. And when a philosophy is revolutionary, it's very easy to wrap it up, with a lot of the bad, with a lot of the Marxist stuff, which is revolutionary as well. It's funny that Ayn Rand, when she was first alerted to a libertarian movement, I think she called these people hooligans. But what's really, really important here is balance, right? It's important to balance criticism and skepticism with something that is affirmative. In the beginning of my show, I had no idea about this balance. I was a young, angry libertarian, and I didn't have a board. like a dry erase board where I said, okay, this is the vision that I have for the future of education, and this is the mission that I have for a media project, and these are the goals that I want to achieve. I said school sucks. And at this point, we're kind of stuck with that. But in this almost recklessly think fast media culture that we live in, it is so easy to just get sucked right in to all of the negativity, especially when the enemies of freedom seem so insane. But also a lot of there's a lot of gravity towards the easier to criticize, the more fun to criticize enemy of freedom that is the left, and not, you know, to the degree I think it should be, the Trump administration. Some of us, even myself in certain moments, have been like drawn into a sympathetic position towards them, which is insane if you think about it. And it's very important for me to ask myself, how did I get here? And I think this postmodern exploration and this specific aspect of it that I'm talking about now has given me some valuable insights into that. Because several of these important aspects of deconstruction, if not applied in a balanced way, you know, in the context of a more complete worldview, well, we can give in to lazier types of thinking. Deconstruction can just become destruction. And that's a lot of what we see playing out in some of these radical left movements like Antifa, or even in more mainstream higher education today. So I'm checked. I can check myself by returning to what I'm for, returning to the vision, even if unattainable in my lifetime, for education or for society or for culture. And I compare that to, you know, things that Milo says or things that the Trump administration is trying to bring about. I realize, oh, whoops, you know, sometimes I can wind up sounding like an ally of, you know, not the best people, with really not the best ideas, with dangerous ideas and perhaps even dangerous policies. And it's almost like that idea that I said in a recent show. I wish the enemies of Trump would stop being so damn entertaining so we can actually focus on being watchful of perhaps even more urgent threats to freedom. But we're also trying to head off at the pass, you know, an anti-Trump revolution that is coming, whether it's, you know, violent or political, that is going to be extremely ugly. And I think that's worth talking about as well. So, you know, these are the tricks of our time. So I don't want to completely throw out all the ideas that deconstruction or critical theory bring, because it is, you know, skepticism, it is challenging authority. But I guess this is a call for a balance between being mindful of the predatory forces, but also remembering to focus on the affirmative for me. So one of the mistakes that I think I've made in the past, and something that I'm trying to correct for, is I have this tendency to talk about some phenomenon, some set of ideas, some group of people, or, you know, some particular event as being almost singularly causal in something else, and not realizing that it's actually a confluence of causes that led to some effect that I'm talking about. So people talk about college, and they say, oh, these lefty professors, oh, these social justice warriors. And they're kind of focusing in my opinion, if I go back and listen to older shows, I'm sure I could observe myself making this mistake, focusing in too much on one specific aspect. So it seems very rare that one thing, when you're looking at these larger social or cultural or political phenomena, that one thing would be entirely to blame for something else. So today on the show, our whole conversation is built off of Drew basically saying, you know, what's going on in higher education. And that leads to just an hour of exploration. And there's a metaphor that I like of a river, right? So, you know, you'll watch people talking about I would picture this being something more like Republicans, like Fox News. I could picture hearing this on like the Greg Gutfeld show or something, like, oh, these kids, they're so spoiled. They're always told they were so special and they were given 11th place ribbons. And that's why they talk. That's really why they are doing this. You know, yeah, I mean, that's part of it. But that's like one tributary that runs into a huge river. So today's discussion is trying to make use of this metaphor. And it's applicable in other areas as well. So you'll hear Drew today talk about some economic problems that might be on the horizon, bubbles bursting. And, you know, it took me back to hearing like a lot of libertarian criticisms of the support of Ron Paul in 2008 and 2012, where, you know, the gold bugs and the Austrians had been saying for a long time, like, look, this is not sustainable. There's going to be a major economic catastrophe. And you don't want Ron Paul at the helm when that happens, because that's all people are going to connect it to. And the same is perhaps true with Donald Trump. And I'm not suggesting that this is some kind of grand conspiracy, but, you know, this is a thought that has crossed my mind, is that Donald Trump makes a perfect kind of patsy for economic catastrophes that basically had, you know, plenty of momentum on their own before he even came into office. So because the public memory is so short, and because, you know, the water in this Donald Trump stream is so choppy, as we all in 2017 run into the big river on the Donald Trump tributary, people don't even notice the power of the flow that's behind us when it comes to, you know, political corruption, Keynesian economics, the impact of U.S. foreign policy going back to the establishment of the Federal Reserve. That's not – most people are never going to notice that, right? We're in Trump River. And I think the same is true with today's higher education crisis. It's a confluence of unhealthy philosophies, mismanagement of institutions in an attempt to be more inclusive, the racial liberalism that we've talked about before with Thaddeus Russell, this egalitarian idea that everybody needs to go to college, generational considerations like the unique challenges that millennials have faced, the impact of technology. All of these things will be discussed. And I hope it's a useful conversation, and it's an idea that could be better developed. So please feel free to post about it in the School Sucks group and talk to each other. I will see those discussions, so I look forward to hearing what you say. I've been talking to a lot of listeners lately. I ran some focus groups on the course that I'm going to try to develop. This is one of the things that I'm working on in the background right now. In the last few weeks, I've had, you know, great conversations with maybe 20 people, and it really motivates me to like get more of your thoughts into the show. So that's up to me. That's my responsibility to figure out how to do that. But even if you don't wind up in a long discussion with me about your thoughts here, please share them and let other people see them and discuss them with others. I think that's a really important thing for us to do. Again, if this is a talk that interests you, I highly recommend you check out my show with Gardner from a couple days ago. It was called The Many Paths to Milogate, and becoming a patron gets you access to that show. So please consider doing that if you can. Also, this was recorded last Friday, so this was before all the Milo news. So towards the end of the conversation, you know, some discussion of Milo and Trump and their self-promotion strategies comes into it. And if you're thinking this was recorded like yesterday, it won't make sense why we're not talking about all this Milo stuff. But it was recorded last Friday, so that's why. And just on one final note, I want you to get access to the Morning Routine Tiny Course. And you might be saying, I don't have time for that right now. I don't have time to do a course. Yeah, that's why it's a tiny course. My goal for this, I was fielding some questions about some of the content from our Productivity Month in January of 2016. And I said, you know, a lot of other people probably have these questions as well. Or even if people don't know they have these questions, they could probably benefit from some of the stuff that I'm writing up about those shows and what I learned from some of our most successful and productive guests. So the goal for this series of emails was basically in 5 minutes or less, over the period of 5 days, you could learn one or two things per day that could really, really help you with your productivity. And the feedback has been really positive. So it's just a tiny little commitment. But I'm pretty sure most of you will get something valuable out of it. And all you have to do is join our email list at schoolsucksproject.com. Have you not been to schoolsucksproject.com in a while? Go have a look. You're going to have internet access today, which is all that's required. So go look over the site and join the email list while you're there. I really appreciate it. All right, everybody, enjoy the show.
Now I taught the weeping willow how to cry, and I showed the clouds how to cover up a clear blue sky. And the tears that I cried for that woman are gonna flood you, big river, and I'm gonna sit right here until I die.
I wanna segue this into universities. Should we talk about what's going on in universities now? I I was like hesitant to bring it up with you because it's like I know you were getting burned out with the speed in politics, but then you just did another episode and you've been thinking about it. And
yeah, I think actually just having all that crap rattle around in my own head is probably not so good. So yeah, absolutely.
All right, so interesting times right now. So you and I both came from the left, and it's like I remember I just watched Dave Rubin on what is that university? He talks about in this little it's like they do like short video clips of people. And he was talking about like why he went from working with the Young Turks and why he found himself leaving, like why he found himself considered being classified on the right. And like I don't really classify myself in either, but it was weird where it's like I don't feel like I've been saying anything different. And I used to have both liberals and conservatives like against me, but now it's like conservatives agree with me more than liberals, and now I have liberals calling me a fascist or anything. So then I started reading Scott Adams' blog about persuasion, and then I started reading all the books he recommended, and then just like kind of studying Trump from that lens. And have you read any of Scott Adams' stuff?
I've read some of his blogs. Yeah, I've read some of his stuff on Trump, and I kind of watched his path to becoming more supportive of Trump than he initially was.
It's like I felt the need, the contrarian in me, just to troll like on Facebook, because it's like nobody wants to have a civil discussion. It's like you were talking about it earlier, and it's like Facebook's whole revenue is based on people having reactions. It's not based on people having conversations. They want you to have quick reactions, and there's like a whole revenue thing to it. And like anything, it's not good or bad. It's just the way you use it.
Right.
And it's been interesting, man. Like I didn't vote, man. I mean, I didn't vote for Trump, but there is this sick part of me that thinks it's hilarious to watch people lose their minds about it and to really push their buttons about it. But I was listening to your last podcast, and the guy said, you know, the protesters, one guy was trying to egg the protester on, and then they said something about his father, and then he lost his mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a weird thing, man. It's like I just called your grandma a whore, but all I really did was say something, my opinion about somebody that I will never meet, you will never meet, but it's like people look at him like it's their own damn family.
Well, I think it's about a heightened state of emotion, right? And it goes back to, we mentioned this already in this conversation, the lack of patience. A lot of what we're seeing in college, you know, Jonathan Haidt, the moral psychologist, who's done a lot of great work on this over the last year, has talked about, well, you know, first of all, this is the helicopter parenting generation grown up. You know, if you're our age or older, and you already spoke to this in this conversation, that you had time by yourself as a youth, right? You could explore. I could ride my bike in a sand pit and, you know, find Playboy magazines that people had left out there when I was like seven. And I lived a very exploratory youth, a lot of it unsupervised. Now, I was fortunate to live in, you know, a fairly safe area, and there's plenty of trouble to get into, but it was a safe place to explore within. And then, you know, I remember being in elementary school and starting to hear these stories about kidnappings. And I remember every day that this girl in the next town got kidnapped, and they never found
her. Stranger danger.
Yeah, yeah. So they never found this girl. And every day on the bus on the way home, somebody would say, the girl, I heard a rumor that the girl's body is in that pond right there. So it's like I grew up in elementary school. By the time elementary school wound to a close, it's like, oh, God, I'm going to get kidnapped. But I had formative years where I was, you know, just kind of a rogue explorer. And that was a cool thing. That was a cool opportunity. Well, the next generation didn't have that opportunity. And today's youth, the kids who are, you know, the seven-year-old me's riding my bike in the sand pit in the 1980s, if their parents allow that today, they could wind up in jail, you know, or they could wind up getting CPS called on them, basically, for like negligence. So as the generation after mine grew up to college age, they didn't have any experience kind of mediating conflicts by themselves or with groups of friends. So it always became about, you know, deferring to authority because, you know, mom or dad or authority figure in Stranger Danger Generation was always hovering over them. So now when there are social conflicts, especially around, you know, political or cultural issues in higher education, it's like authority help me is the cry. And that's kind of coupled in this generation with this lack of an ability to delay gratification. There is no patience now. So it's like I have a problem, I need it solved immediately. I have a question, I need to find knowledge, or, you know, an adequate substitute, a knowledgey feeling thing will do in its place. So people settle for the wrong answers and they want, you know, decisive, authoritative solutions to their problems. People are impatient and lazy, and a lot of those are generational and environmental factors. But when it comes to higher education, there's also this like this postmodern philosophical container that all of this stuff exists in. And it makes for very cloudy debates once you start introducing ideas like everything is subjective, that, you know, reason and evidence are not as important as things like feelings. It's a complicated structure or lack of structure of ideas that postmodernism is, but postmodernism is the prevailing philosophy in higher education in many forms, especially across the social sciences. Postmodernism, to some extent, and the unknowability of reality has even polluted to some extent some of the hard sciences, but it really is at this point a creature of the social sciences and literature programs or arts programs or, you know, all of the group studies like, you know, African American studies, transgender studies, women's studies, those kinds of identity academic pursuits, if you want to call them that. They're all really, really inside this container of postmodernism. And it's very hard to pin people down and actually have meaningful discussions with them because they are elevating your group identity above your individual ability, whether you're able to prove it or not, to make meaning out of the world and to form an argument and to defend an argument. Well, that's because you're white. You're a white male, or you're part of this group, and I have these preconceived, you know, understandings of that group, and I organize things into an oppression hierarchy. So let's not really like think we're actually having a discussion or an exchange of ideas here. You are a tool or a pawn of the oppressor class. You know, so I'm kind of getting this. These things get very, very muddy very quickly, and I'm not maybe helping in my explanation here, but it is very, very hard to have a common rational back and forth. And, you know, that I think that confluence of factors, whether it's philosophical or anti-philosophical, you know, in the case of postmodernism, and it isn't like there weren't competent thinkers who were trying to do important things in the world of ideas. But it's kind of like, you ever see the movie Multiplicity with Michael Keaton and he keeps copying himself and then you get to like version 4 and is, you know, like the fourth clone of a clone of a clone.
Hi, Steve.
Yeah, is basically retarded, right?
So yeah, I love it.
So postmodernism, if you follow the legacy of ideas, you go back to some really important philosophers like Immanuel Kant, but as they steer further and further, you know, away from Enlightenment thinking, it gets like really anti-objectivity, and it just it opens the door for a lot of just ideological messes, basically, and that's the environment of higher education today. So that explains, I think, to some extent, why we're seeing a lot of these things.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense, man. I forget what somebody said, but like America's religion, national religion, is really individualism, and it's pretty popular amongst the West, but especially here in the United States. It seems like postmodernism is just kind of it's counterintuitive to individualism. It's like they want individualism, but they don't want to be responsible for themselves. And at the same time, people need to have, it's just so weird, like they just want to have victims that they can say, oh, what about these people? They don't get it. And And at the same time, man, whenever I hear these people talking about it, like, it seems like most people that have that opinion that, you know, the whatever that goofy shit is, cultural appropriation, they've never lived in a black neighborhood. They've never been outside a large white, you know, white area. And I'm always wonder, like, okay, well, what's your zip code? And then I look it up and I'm like, yeah, that's not very diverse. I mean, that's pretty white. Or even celebrities that are talking about, you know, we need to let these refugees in. It's like, well, okay, well, you got all these mansions. So you're going to let these people live with you. Like, what's your solution? Are you going to be, you just want to, it's kind of like a weird thing that I don't know. I feel like a lot of it's driven by white guilt, honestly. And like, that's what I see. And I could be wrong, but I know in my generation, man, I mean, it was a weird thing, man. I remember growing up in a liberal family and I had some white guilt, but at the same time, it wasn't my mom was super liberal, but she's also a social worker. And she always is like she was like an AIDS and HIV social worker. So, and she predominantly worked in black neighborhoods and she would predominantly go to help them with education. And she'd felt being shunned out, like, oh, you're not a part of this community. You're not allowed to help us because you're white. And she's felt that, but she kept doing it anyways. And so like, it's totally different than now where it's just people just want to complain.
Well, we see a lot of behavior that's more driven by irrational emotion than actually making arguments, right? So you talk about the migrant crisis and people saying, you know, going to the airport and chanting, no hate, no fear, Muslims are welcome here. And as if that's the only discussion that needs to be had about this vastly complex situation where, you know, you have, you know, mixed into these groups of people fleeing these countries that, you know, the U.S. has been bombing for at least the last 8 years, if not longer in some cases. And, you know, some of them are Christian and they've been persecuted in those countries. And some of them are Muslim. And if they get here and they're just sort of put on some kind of government assimilation into society program, how is that going to go for them? Like, do these people who are saying, you know, open our borders and let these people in, are they even like thinking it through? And I'm talking about mostly people on the left. Like, I mean, I understand the libertarian open borders argument, but these people who have this dream of a multicultural utopia, do they think it through to the point where it's like, okay, now you're here? You know, whether you're a depending on the country and depending on the group, you know, are you a Sunni or a Shia, and what kind of neighborhood are you in, and how do you navigate this culture with, you know, your children that you want to raise a certain way, and would you have been better, you know, fitting into a safe zone that was established in an already predominantly Muslim country somewhere in the Middle East where there was a more homogeneous population where you would have felt more comfortable with your family? Like, oh, these people don't give a shit about any of that. They just want to do a chant that makes them feel good. And this speaks to the exact problem. It's this container that seems to have overtaken thought that is the entire left, that is all of higher education, you know, that undermines Enlightenment thought. Ayn Rand would roll in her grave, as would most dead objectivists if they saw what was going on. You know, it's all subjectivity. It's anti-realism, ethics of emotion and feelings and relativism. And, you know, it's the political state of collectivism and egalitarianism. So in our own lives, as we try to make meaning and we try to accomplish things, we have at least like a strong desire to adhere to reality and reason and cause and effect. But if we, you know, in our political thinking, in our philosophical thinking, like this is the case with the modern left, if we let those things go, what governs us? It's our feelings, you know? It's our emotions. They take center stage. And I'm not saying – we've wrestled with this on the show for a long time. You know, like, emotions are inextricable from our thinking patterns. We have to take emotional inventories. We have to understand the emotional landscape, you know, that we live in personally. And we have to defend our emotions from outside attacks because we know they can be deceptive and they're often reckless. But basically, you know, what seems to be emerging in a lot of political and philosophical thought, and this is over the course of the last half century, is, you know, not anymore. You know, just your emotions supersede. you know, all of these constrictive patriarchal structures of debate, logic and definitions of words, like that's all part of an oppressive system. Like there are postmodern, and postmodernness again is very, postmodernism is very vast. So there's people who would not agree with this, but there are also postmodernists who have forwarded those ideas that science itself is in some cases is oppressive, that language itself is oppressive and exclusionary in ways that it shouldn't be. So, you know, we are left with just feelings and the contents of a lot of the beliefs being taught in college, whether it's like, you know, German idealism or romanticism, which has all of these dark feelings or suspicion and hyper-skepticism about the world, or Marx and victimization, other things like, you know, throwing out logic and reasoning. It produces a real mess. Emotionally, and I think that's a contributing factor to a lot of the things that we're seeing, is that emotion has been elevated above reason and identity has been elevated above individuality and individual merit to make arguments and make meaning in the world.
No, I 100% agree, man. That was good stuff. I mean, do you think a lot of this stems from like Stranger Danger? I mean, do you think that like that's that whole Stranger Danger thing is what kind of got us started on this path?
It's very interesting. And I was trying to like form a metaphor to offer my theory. And I was trying to decide whether it was like a confluence of streams that run into a big river, right? And you said you felt like Stranger Danger is where this all began. I think that might be for people our age, like we're pretty close in age, that was kind of where we ran into the big river, right? That was like our first exposure. But behind us, where we entered that river, that tributary into that river that we came in on, there was already a huge river flowing behind us. And then I wondered too if like in this river – one of the things I learned when I was teaching kids kayaking is that a river flows because it's just kind of like sheets of water on top of each other. This is how it was explained to me. And at the bottom, you have what's harder to see, what's colder and deeper and darker is a stronger current, a more powerful current. And as you get close to the top, you know, the water moves faster and it gets very choppy. And you can think about, you know, I think about my own life this way sometimes. Like I have maybe these things that would probably be best addressed in therapy that are deep and dark and very strong in how they affect my life. And then you go up to like a middle current that's easier to see but also fairly strong, that's like the stresses about health and finances and these kinds of things. But then at the top where the water is choppy and most visible, it's all like some asshole cut me off in traffic, or I had this fight on Facebook, or I saw this thing that pissed me off, or I, you know, I stubbed my toe on a chair in the dark. You know, so all of these things together make up this sort of stressful river of life. But I think that also works for this larger phenomenon to an extent. It's not perfect, but years ago, like maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I made this YouTube video called The American Way, which was kind of like, how did this happen in Nazi Germany? Oh my God, look, is America like this? I think it's kind of I don't think the video holds up today. I think it's still interesting. But I said, well, you know, we got their school system. So we got their system of authority and collectivism imposed on us, imposed on what was post-Enlightenment and post-Founding Fathers and Bill of Rights, a fairly like freedom-oriented and individualistic culture. And then this kind of system of authority in training the youth was imposed on it. But then, so that's one part of that river, right? And then there's also deep and dark and a strong current of the philosophical ideas that came from America's relationship with Central Europe and a lot of these German thinkers, you know, the Immanuel Kant and Hegel and the idea of the state and collectivism. And then, you know, all these other currents about, you know, the postmodernists. It's all moving in the same river. And then we see whether that river is causal of these other things like Stranger Danger or the social justice. It's all kind of like running together now into this very, very, very strong current. So we picked it up in one place, but it ran behind us for a long time quite powerfully, I think. And now there is this confluence of all these different factors. The impatience of the online world, the helicopter parents, kids grown up, these long, deep philosophical currents that have affected Western thought for almost two centuries at this point, the relationship of people to authority, the minimization of the individual in favor of the collective, like all of these things come together in 2017 in some ways that are really quite ugly and not so promising for the future.
How do you think when the inevitable education bubble bursts, that's going to affect colleges and all this nonsense that's going on in colleges? Like, do you think there's still going to be people? I mean, that's the weird thing, too, that I think about. It's like not only are you getting yourself in so much debt that you have a mortgage payment, you're not going to get a job, like most likely you're not going to. In your line of study, you might work at Starbucks or something like that and get all upset because they have expectations of you. And you know, whatever, I am making some generalizations about, you know, this, you know, helicopter parenting and everything, culture or kids that have grown up or this instant gratification children. Like, you know, like my buddy used to teach and I went through this in college, like, oh, I'm here. You know, there's definitely people that go to college because they want to get a job, not to get an education. And it's interesting because you used to go to college and get an education. You used to be able to pay your own way through school and you would work for it. But now, you know, now that the government took over student loans, we have this huge bubble. The colleges are raising costs because students have unlimited sources of free money that never existed before. And so they're raising their tuition. And so these kids are going in all this debt and then they're going to school and all they're doing is complaining, bitching, chanting and shouting. I feel like sometimes I'm like, I wonder what would happen if we did just get fire hoses and start spraying these kids. Would they still want to protest? Would this vindicate them in their shouting and their beliefs? Like, what do we do about these kids? And it's like, you know, when this education bubble bursts, and there's not all this free money, if it does go away, I mean, you know, this indentured servitude that you sign up for since you can't, you can't file bankruptcy and get rid of the student debt. Like,
right.
I'm just like, there's all these factors, man, that I see economically that are connected. I mean, like, I just saw like the auto bubble's going to burst here soon. And maybe, I don't know. I always think that and then it doesn't. I mean, what are they going to do when they don't have a place to live? Because let's say their parents lose their house in this next real estate bubble. Like, these people are bitching about things that aren't real, and maybe in some circumstances, but a lot of times they're blown out of proportion. But then there's real things to worry about. There's real things that I see, like economically and financially, you don't know skills to survive. You don't know skills. And I'm not saying this from a survivalist perspective, but I'm just saying, like, they don't have anything real to bring to the table except for how to be not necessarily good at being disruptive. Like, I think there's like a positive disruption, but then there's also like a negative disruption too. I don't know.
Yeah. The higher education, first of all, is a huge mess. And because of the availability of what is now federal money to get people into college and this egalitarian vision, which is part of that same river that I was just speaking about,
yeah,
that everybody should go to college. Well, a lot of kind of shiftless nitwits wind up there. And a lot of people who would be, and it's not like they're destined to be nitwits. It's just like they spend 15,000 hours in another form of school that didn't prepare them to be independent thinkers working towards self-actualization or directing themselves towards a career, because it was entirely about dependence and extrinsic motivation. So, like, college is very much the 13th grade. It is the continuation of school. It is the continuation of dependency. This is one of the things Jonathan Haidt spoke about, is that, you know, there's this deference to authority to solve these social problems in higher education. So you have a college population, a growing college population, that is not being prepared to do anything while incurring enormous debts. And when people go to college without, you know, clear you know, a clearly defined path to some extent, they wind up in these stupid social sciences programs that there's no jobs on the other side of other sides of those things, right? So they're just wasting time and wasting money. Now, those people who take those lessons that they learn in those places and they go out and they do all this silly, you know, screaming and shouting, or they call it activism, and they put on these, you know, theatrical performances, that's still a minority of college students. And I think most people in college, I think if you went to I live near Dartmouth, which is an Ivy League school, and there's a lot of people there, and they've had a few of these incidents there. So I bet if you went there and you saw a group of students putting on some kind of, you know, demonstration or outrage performance, most other Dartmouth students would look at them and be like, oh my God, these people are so annoying. I would still think that would even be a majority of people there. But that minority is very vocal. And because of this habit of deferring to authority and because of their impatience, pressures are going to be applied, right? We've seen in the last couple of years at schools like Mizzou and Claremont McKenna, people have resigned in response to these dust-ups and these protests and this outrage. So Jonathan Haidt has even talked about one of his classes being shut down because a social justice warring student was offended by something that he presented in a video because it mentioned homosexuality. So people who do go to college to learn, you know, I mean, Haidt teaches psychology, so that's, you know, a valid study. They're having their learning opportunities infringed upon by all of this noise and drama and performance that people are putting on in college. The institutions are becoming less stable, number one, because of how they get their funding and because of the bureaucratic nature that funding contributes to. So there are still valuable things to do in college. You know, you can go to a research university. You can go to an engineering school. You might really be excited about a career that can only be attained through a college track. But I don't know what the bubble bursting. It's not really a bubble because there's nothing – there's no product, you know? There's no tangible – like the housing market had a bubble. But then when the bubble burst, the banks could go and take something back. In college, there is nothing to take back, you know? Like, what are they going to do? Take your degree and just have a warehouse like at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark where they're just filled with people's college degrees in boxes? I mean, I don't know. For a long time, people like us have talked about the shit hitting the fan. And it seems like right now that's becoming very palpable, right? That we know something is coming. A lot of people who are libertarians have moved away from academic discussions into more practical talk. Did you ever think you'd hear libertarians debating a border wall or immigration laws? Those things are happening now, right? So there is a shift. There is a kind of quickening. To speak to what you said, you know, you put this in with higher education and a bunch of other things that appear to be on the horizon. It seems like this feeling is growing that there are tensions and difficulties ahead. And I certainly think, considering the amount of money that is wrapped up in higher education right now, you know, not even considering how much of it is actually in default, but it's over $1 trillion. Yeah, that could be a catalyst for a lot of economic hardships for sure.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, man. My brother, he's going for marine biology and he's doing really well. And as much as I pound my chest to not go to school, like, it was something that for him, I was like, you know, man, well, do something that you can learn a skill too. And it's actually cool. You know, he was like the only community college kid to get this paid internship for marine biology at the University of Washington last summer because he works hard. And it's like, and I like to think I've helped him with that. Like, you know, he applied for these internships his first year. He didn't get it, so he went to the writing center, and then he got a few offers because he's learning. He just keeps focusing on skills. Oh, I'm not a good writer, so I need to focus on how can I write better. And, you know, instead of saying this is unfair, he just kept working harder. And so I think that is still there, just like what you said. Like, a majority of kids aren't social justice warriors, but the loudest ones are.
But they also need to be prepared, right? Like part of what I try to do is like break the news to, even though I have, you know, a fairly small audience compared to the number of people who need to be reached, I'm happy to see that there's so much of an effort through outlets like, you know, whether it's McGinnis or Milo or Rebel Media, to inform high school age kids, more high school age kids, what the college environment is increasingly looking like these days. Because I think one of the reasons why a lot of young people get wrapped up in a lot of this bullshit is they have no intellectual self-defense. They have no emotional self-defense, and they're blindsided by this college culture. So no one is prepared to go to college and be in that environment. I certainly wasn't. You know, I remember being there, being in college, and on like day three, being like, do we drink every night? You know, and then like day seven, is it okay to throw beer bottles at the payphone at 2 a.m.? You know, like no, there was no preparation for any of this. And now when you look at those toxic social environments, it's like they're going to subsume more people just because people are not prepared for what they're encountering, right? We live in a society where most people are just kind of apolitical and not deep thinkers about a lot of political and philosophical issues. So they have a tendency to just drift to the left. You know, the media leans to the left, Hollywood leans to the left, social, Facebook, Google, YouTube are all, you know, skewed to the left. So if you just exist in the world, you know, without really strong intellectual self-defenses or without really living consciously and continuously questioning what you're being exposed to and why, and you prioritize other things over like a political or a philosophical identity, you're just going to drift to the left. Like a current is just going to take you that way. And in higher education, that current is much, much stronger. And people haven't – not only have they not gotten, you know, intellectual self-defense skills, but they're also – just this is just from my experience of almost a decade of working with kids in that age group. They're not particularly good at, you know, asserting themselves, standing out against the crowd, if it means there's going to be social costs for doing so. So you see in these rallies, in these protests, in college students speaking at events, there's just a lot of virtue signaling and people trying to fit in. They want to be part of the crowd. Everything goes in that direction. So why wouldn't I? You know, we're tribal. We don't want to be isolated on a college campus. And they're saying things like, you know, it used to be hard to come out as gay in college. Now imagine saying you're like a Republican in college. You know,
dude, it's crazy. It's dangerous.
Yeah,
it's dangerous to say you're a Trump supporter. I mean, I'm definitely not a Trump supporter. But people that weren't even for Hillary but were anti-Trumpers, it's like they're in such denial about the violence of the left. Like the first thing you see is people openly live streaming, beating the shit out of a white person for insane. And my mom actually made a good point. Like maybe it was politically motivated, or maybe it was just something for them to say. While they were, she's like, either way, it's a hate crime. But, you know, maybe it's just something they were saying because they were just fucking sickos. And I was like, well, that's definitely a possibility. It's scary, man. It's scary. Like as much as I'd like to troll and walk around with like a Make America Great Again hat, like just to troll people or just for laughs, that's a dangerous just for laughs thing to do. So I wouldn't do it. Like it's like, I'll do it on Facebook, like just to mess with people just for laughs. And maybe I should stop doing it. Maybe I shouldn't. Sometimes I can actually generate a lot of discussion from it, like civil discussion. I feel like we just keep drifting towards wanting confrontation, like a need for confrontation for some reason. And maybe it's because we're not confronting things internally, so we're looking to do it externally. I don't know. I think there's something deeper going on. But even like it's weird. You were saying about the confrontation in liberty, like there's a huge one. And it's weird was it all started. It seemed like for me when I started paying attention to it was Stephen Molyneux goes, vote for Trump. He represents the anti-establishment, blah, blah, blah. Then Jeffrey Tucker, I hear, go on Chris Stefanik's show, Choice Conversations. And Jeffrey Tucker's like, Trump's a fascist. That's the first time I ever heard Trump said as a fascist. He goes, you should read the Turner Diaries. You should read these books. And it's a possibility a man that's not owed to anything could be this. And I'm like, well, that's an interesting thought. But then it's like I feel like a lot of these arguments or this confrontation, it seems like it's trickling from the liberty. Maybe it's my ego saying that, but it seems like I see things first in liberty, and then I see it start to trickle out to mainstream. It's interesting to see how much conflict there really is. And it's like, you know, it's uncomfortable, I guess, is the best way to put it. But it's like people are going out of their way to provoke the opposite side a whole lot more. And I know I'm doing it because I think I did it just because I think people are being stupid. So I'm going to poke the bear and see what happens. But maybe other people do that too. Maybe that's a bad thing for me to do. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it depends on why people are doing it, right? And there's a variety of strategies. I mean, one of the reasons why people troll is to feel efficacious. Yeah. Like if you can suck somebody else into whatever you're doing. Now, sometimes it's just a strategy. Sometimes it's just a learning opportunity. Like I know people that I've seen troll, and at first I was like, why are they doing it? And then I've kind of realized it's almost a kind of social experiment. And I was motivated by my webmaster just by watching him do it. And I don't really love his style of doing it, but I did it a couple weeks ago, and I learned a lot. Not like, wow, you know, the other side has a really good story and I was being naive to not recognize it. It's nothing like that. I learned a lot about them socially and emotionally. Yeah. Like I gathered information from doing that. Now, for most people, if it's not a learning opportunity, I think it's a way of feeling efficacious. It's a way of having an impact. I think that, you know, having a show is a good outlet for that. Right. So I couldn't imagine. I'm not sure how I would behave online if I didn't have this outlet, or if I didn't have a community of people that I could talk to about these things. It might get more bottled up, you know, and kind of explode outward more forcefully or more antisocially. And, you know, the world's always been a plenty violent place. There's no doubt. But it almost seems like we're starting to see the kinds of interactions that happen on Facebook spill out into the real world, right? Where trolling is online trolling almost has like a 3D meat world form now. Even watching other contentious political campaigns, like over the last 10 or 15 years, there was nothing like this. Like people are trolling IRL now. And that seems to be kind of a new phenomenon where it's very much just about getting that response from people.
Yeah.
Now, it depends. This could also be a kind of promotional strategy, as it is with Milo and the like, right?
Yeah. Did you read that article I sent that Ryan Halliday wrote?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we should talk about it for a few minutes if you want. But it's that is coming – that online behavior where if you meet somebody on Facebook – like back, you know, people were fighting on Facebook 4 or 5 years ago. If you met somebody on Facebook who you didn't know and it was like in the context of some political disagreement, you would be calling them names and gaslighting them and all of that stuff. But if you happen to meet that person in real life at the supermarket by coming around, you know, the corner at the same time and bumping carriages, it would be like, oh, so sorry. I'm so clumsy. Ha ha. You know, it's so the real world used to be different. And now I think, like I said, it's not the social media is not a catalyst for violence in the real world. Violence has always existed, but we're seeing like social media stranger behavior that was always permissible online because there was that barrier, there was that safety. We're almost seeing this emergence of groups of people who don't care about the barrier not being there in the real world, and they live so much online. And they get so much, positive feelings or self-efficacy from doing these things online. They've taken it to the streets in this last campaign. I never saw that before. Milo, on the other hand, is a master of it. You know, he's used it to propel himself to the top of the Amazon bestseller list.
Yeah. I mean, and he's doing it, and it's so interesting because when Ryan Halliday – and I've read – I think it's the same Ryan Halliday, you know, friends with Tim Ferriss, The Obstacle's the Way.
I would assume because it is him, yeah.
Yeah, because I did get that book on Audible. I found a cool Audible hack too Brett, which I can share with you. You can actually get Audible credits on eBay, and Ooh. You can get like 15 credits for $25, and they work. It's pretty crazy. So people search eBay and do that. You don't have to pay $14.95 a month for one book. So anyways, with that being said, so I got that book, and I haven't read it yet, but I read that article. My friend Neil posted it, and I was listening to you talk with I'm going to butcher his name, so I'm not even going to say it, but on your last show.
Biffo,
yeah.
Yeah.
And you were kind of talking about that. Like, do you think this is a strategy of rebel media to get popular? I mean, not only are they shedding light on stuff that's going on in universities, but, you know, when in that article, and I'll post a link in the show notes, but basically Ryan Halliday says he helped promote Tucker Max, which a lot of people probably don't remember, but him and Maddox were kind of in the same, like, provocative area. Like Maddox, I don't know if, do you remember Maddox, like xmission.com?
And I think so. Yeah.
Like, your kids, like, my art's better than your kids. He grade people's art.
Yeah.
And he'd just say, I'm better than your kids. I can run faster, read better. And it was like this big goof, but people would get super offended by it because he took real kids' art that he saw from his work and he posted the photos on his website and set up, and he gave them all F's and stuff. It was hilarious. And then Tucker and Max, they did something similar. And if they knew that people were coming in town, if Tucker was going to be in town to talk about a book signing, they would report people that they knew opposed Tucker to get hype. And it's actually something, man. Honestly, man, it's like something from pro wrestling. It's like the heel move of pro wrestling, or to watch Chael Sonnen do it in MMA, or even, you know, just it's like this being a provocateur is a marketing strategy or PR strategy that people don't give enough respect to.
Yeah.
And just like what you're saying about Myler, even Donald Trump, man.
Donald Trump strategy. It's also the Slate and Salon and, you know, the Huffington Post strategy, where they write these – I mean, Slate and Salon, and I fell for this back in the day a bunch of times. They would write these ridiculous, like, I used to be a libertarian, and then I woke up, and now I'm a Clinton supporter. Like, that would be their headline, yeah. Right? So who shares that on Facebook? Mostly people who are pro-liberty, but who do those people have in their news feed who are seeing that story? Probably a lot of people that are oriented towards the left, if, you know, the overall population is any indication, especially if it's a young person who, you know, would pick up Slate or Salon or Huffington Post articles. So, you know, the article talks about Milo gets this press, right? And yep. the tactic is to basically leverage the size of their non-audience, right? So they do something outrageous. 100,000 people hear about it. 90,000 are outraged. And 10,000 are like, huh, what's this? I'm going to look into this. And you're absolutely right. Trump did the exact same thing. But in Trump's case, it was almost smarter. Like Milo, if he goes and he upsets 100,000 people, maybe he can suck in 5 or 10 to check him out and start consuming his work. And then they say, oh, this guy's smart and entertaining. And I'm glad some outraged nitwit on CNN told me about him. But Trump was playing more – so if we call Milo's strategy like the 90-10 strategy, 90% of people are going to hate me, 10% of people are going to love me. Trump was playing more of like a 40-20-40 strategy, which is typically, you know, the voter makeup, right? You have 40% of people are going to go one way no matter what. 40% of the people are going to go the other way no matter what. And it's what you do with the 20% in between that decides the election. So it seemed like Trump – who is a media personality, took the temperature of the country, and he said, all right, well, who do people think is awesome, right? Tony Soprano, Frank Underwood, Walter White, the anti-heroes. And you always want to go back and see what they're going to do next. And these shows also drive huge ratings. So Trump's team, or just Trump himself – I don't know who else was involved in this strategy.
I mean, Kevin Geary pointed out his Twitter. I mean, Trump's Twitter is so powerful.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's unreal. Like, honestly, man, it's fucking hilarious. Like, he doesn't want to use the POTUS account so he can still use his own account to talk shit to people.
Yeah.
I mean, people are like, do you really want your president of the United States to do that? It's like, man, the president of the United States doesn't really do anything I want him to do, so fuck it. Like, it's funny. Like, I want entertainment. And I think that's how a lot of people feel.
Right. But it worked to grab enough people out of that swayable 20% to his side, because he was going to embolden and consolidate the 40%, even though there was like a lot of friction in the Republican Party and there was a lot of division over Trump and he wasn't their choice candidate. Once he got the nomination, like, that talk largely subsided. There were, you still had the Never Trumpers, but most people got on board. Right. By the time the Republican, I was thinking there was going to be like a riot at the Republican convention, but there wasn't. People were on board. He even like brought Ted Cruz up on stage and fed him to the wolves, you know, in this kind of like Roman spectacle. It was an interesting thing, and everybody loved it. Everybody ate it up. So the other thing that Trump tries to do that Milo succeeds at doing, because his opponents are mostly so repulsive, is he's able to establish the moral high ground. Like, most of Trump's stories that he tells, like even in this press conference yesterday, is about how he's a victim, right?
Yeah.
Now, that's what gets you in America, positioning yourself as the underdog, even if that's like a tough sell for some people. If you can get people to buy into the idea that you're an underdog, that's why he pitted himself against the media. The media is so powerful and the media is so dishonest, and I'm going to take them on and we're going to drain the swamp, the big, powerful swamp. He, you know, this guy worth billions of dollars who has, you know, all of this access, positions himself as the David in this David and Goliath battle. And I think to some extent that's legitimate. But
I think more people that hate him watch his press conferences than people. Man, it reminds me of when Howard Stern first got popular.
Yeah.
It's like the same fucking thing. More people are tuning in that don't like him than that like him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you. You were making a good point.
No, so I think that's one of the things that the article talks about, is that, you know, Trump is continuously trying to grab the moral high ground, which slowly allows him to win over more people. And then, you know, he's kind of I read an article recently on the show about how he's turned postmodernism against itself by playing the antihero, by dealing in basically untruth or anti-truth or anti-realism. You know, like people used to, you know, the left would say, you're a racist, you're a sexist. And they'd go, oh, no, I'm not. I'm sorry. How can I fix it? Oh, I don't want to be called that. It hurts my feelings. Trump just owns it. He's like, yeah, I'm a bad guy, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, no. But he never comes out. And like you see in interviews, the interviewer has to ask these leading questions and try and like pull condemnation of you know, the more radical, like alt-right or neo-Nazis or the Ku Klux Klan, will you disavow them? Will you disavow David Duke? He's like, I don't know David Duke. I don't know what that is. I don't know Putin. You know, he won't come down and say, no, this is terrible. And, you know, he won't play their game. He just dances around it.
He's a master persuader, man, like Scott Adams says.
And the effect is that not just does it win people over, I think the way it wins people over is that he keeps himself we live in a Donald Trump world. He keeps himself at the front of the press every single day. And the more immersed people get in Trump, there's more people are going to be repulsed, but you also have more people are going to come to his side. You know, it reminds me, one of my favorite filmmakers is Martin Scorsese.
Love.
And you watch a movie like Taxi Driver with Travis, or you watch a movie like Raging Bull with Jake LaMotta, or Goodfellas with Henry Hill. And at some point in the film, you say to yourself, am I really fucking rooting for this guy? You know, but you are, you know, he's the protagonist. And
even the Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah. To a certain extent, like when things go wrong, you're like, oh, it hurts my heart a little bit. And that's part of this anti-hero phenomenon. I think, you know, Tony Montana was from Scarface was another example of this. How at the end of the movie, he kind of shouts down all those rich people at the country club who are trying to judge him for a drug dealer. Like, you people are any good? Like, you're the good people? And Trump mastered that. You know, he pitted himself against this exciting anti-hero, against the boring, you know, outrage queen.
Yeah. Too.
And conservatives, too. It's like, you can all clutch your pearls and feign your outrage. That's fine. people are tired of it and I'm going to expose it. So it's very similar. The article that I read pointed out that it was a nice parallel to that Tony Montagna speech from Scarface. You know, Ryan Holiday, who wrote this article, and he, I think he was doing it as like kind of a warning because he had used this strategy to help Tucker Max like 4 or 5 years ago. And I think he even wrote a book about it called Trust Me, I'm Lying.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Confessions
it's
of a Media.
I can share that in the but it's Confessions of something. But yeah, that's
a media manipulator. Yeah.
Yes.
So I think in that book, I've heard him tell this story elsewhere. He talks about somebody set up a website called shipyouretemiesglitter.com, right? And it wasn't a real – so it says this is a service where for $5 you can send an envelope filled with glitter to a friend or an enemy. And there is
a real dog shit service like that too. You can ship someone dog shit.
And this service was entirely fake. There is no real dog shit. There is no real glitter. It was just – it was fake. There was no product. There was no company infrastructure. There was no R&D. It was just a website. So he started sharing it on social media, you know, posting about it on Reddit, Twitter, StumbleUpon, wherever. And this buzz started to get generated. And then he took the buzz generated on these social media platforms and he linked it to social news and email or local news and emails. And he said, hey, look at this phenomenon that's happening online. Everyone's going crazy about this ship your glitter to shipyourenemiesglitter.com. You know? So then the local news is like, they take the bait and they go, oh, that's really interesting. Look at this strange phenomenon and all of these links that are coming to us. So this is certainly a real thing. And then they create stories. And then the guy takes those stories and he sends them to bigger media outlets and they take the bait because they have to fill 24 hours a day of news or they have to, you know, put 12 things on a blog every day or 100 things on a blog, depending on what blog it is. And then the guy sells the company for $100,000 based on hype. You know, and there's no company. So I remember hearing Ryan Holiday tell that story. And if you just compare that to this strategy of, you know, it's a little different in this case, but Trump just walked around and Milo just walks around, you know, aspiring beekeeper, basically, or, you know, pest control person, just whacking bees' nests. And saying, oh, look at all these bees, and wagging another bee's nest. It's quite clever, but it's worked out. It worked out for Trump. It worked out for Milo. And, Holiday wrote the book on this, so it worked out for him as well.
So one thing that I think that's interesting, man, is how people still think that Trump is some dummy. And I feel like the biggest thing you can do is to think that he's stupid because you just dismiss any real danger that could potentially be there. And they think he's dangerous because he is so dumb. But I'm like, he's not dumb. Like, he's not – look, you don't get to where he is by being dumb. Now, he is an asshole. He is narcissistic. He is – you know, he is a little bit of a – I mean, yeah, he's an asshead for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, being an asshole doesn't make you stupid. I mean, the guy has lived the way – the guy – I remember hearing Kevin Smith tell the story about when he worked with Prince.
Yes.
And how he like had such an issue with Prince. And then like Prince's manager was like, well, Prince has been living in Princeland for so long. Like I literally have to – he'll call me at 1 in the morning and say, hey, I want to get a camel right now. And I have to explain to him how it's not physically possible to get a camel in Minnesota at 1 in the morning in December.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the same thing that I think about with Trump, man. Like he has lived a lifestyle that most people are only going to dream of his whole life. Obviously, he's going to act a lot different than most people. But that's also the weird thing, because the people who got behind him first were like rural Americans or even union workers, man. Like, this is the first election where I've seen union workers just not go with the Democrats. Say, you know what? We've been fucked too long. Fuck it. And literally, it's just them throwing a brick through the establishment and saying, if you don't want to represent us, then you're going to get this guy. And that's the way I've looked at it the whole time. Like, not only is Trump a master persuader, not only is is he like, I mean, and also too, if we look at the positives of Trump, and look, I'm not a supporter, but now the Republican Party or conservatism as we know it is 100% different. And now the Democratic Party has to do something 100% different if they want to get Trump out of office. And it's like, so he is so disruptive in that sense that the system is going to have to change. Is it going to be for the better? Or is it going to be for the worse? I don't know. I really don't know. But I do see, man, I do see a lot of young conservatives posturing up to try to get whatever conservative money they probably can to support their independent shows. And I don't want to say names, but it's pretty apparent. I think it's interesting times, man. I mean, like, people are trying to posture up to take advantage or get on this Trump wagon.
Right.
And it's interesting, man. I mean, you saw it early. I saw it with Newt Gingrich. And Newt, I thought, was going to be a cabinet member. But that was interesting, too. Because he went on, like, Megyn Kelly's show. And he's like, you know, he's basically saying that she's a fraud. And she goes, well, you know how I feel about Clinton. He goes, okay, well, then just say it in a sentence. Bill Clinton, sexual predator. You've done it with Donald Trump 100 times. Why can't you say it about Bill Clinton? And she never said it. And then I think like a month later, she announced that she was leaving Fox.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, and I'm just saying, yeah, it's interesting when people like Newt Gingrich or people like Piers Morgan, who's saying like, you know, we can't call Trump Hitler. And he has people like who's actually a funny ass comic, but just getting all irrational and attacking him on Bill Maher's show. I forget his name. He's like, I can see his face.
The Jim Jeffries. Yeah, that was so ridiculous. Like, these are the smart, responsible people today, right? When Piers Morgan speaks up and says, it's not a Muslim ban, which, you know, is definitely a position that could be argued considering there's 75 majority Muslim countries in the world or 57. Sorry, I think 57 majority Muslim countries in the world and 50 are not on this list. You know, I mean, calling it a Muslim ban is very directed. And it's, of course, just the latest in leftist manipulation, language manipulation tricks. So when Piers Morgan –
your defense is to say fuck off and give somebody the bird on TV and say –
while the crowd eggs them on. Yeah, while the crowd eggs them on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
So, you know, I mean, it's this whole Trump is stupid thing. I think it's interesting because, you know, there is this question of what does Trump actually know? How good of an operator is Trump actually? So he's proven his competence in kind of puppeteering the media. Now, the pattern that I've noticed over, you know, my life paying attention to this stuff is every president is somebody's tool. Is somebody's vehicle. Obama was young and inexperienced, and a lot of people had his ear. You know, all their efforts were very much retarded by they are saying the Republicans won't do anything. They won't let us do anything because they kept stopping, you know, Obama's agenda. So if, you know, Obama had a rubber stamp Congress, it could have been a very, very different outcome of his presidency as far as what was carried forward. Bush was very much a tool of the neoconservatives and their foreign policy agenda. Clinton, who was very much a schemer, you know, in his own right, was also, you know, presiding over a lot of sort of international neoliberal economic projects, especially like in Southeast Asia, that he probably didn't fully understand. And he had that whole like Larry Summers crew, you know, in his administration. So every administration is a vehicle for somebody. I mean, pretty much over my whole life anyway. Maybe that's a relatively new phenomenon in history. But I think the whole Trump is stupid thing is kind of shifting. It's shifting more towards Trump is being manipulated by this darker faction inside his administration run by Steve Bannon. And Steve Bannon has this direct line to like neo-reactionaries and alt-righters and neo-Nazis. And with Breitbart, it's an easy connection to make very sloppily. So people see Trump as maybe not stupid, but that maybe that doesn't even matter because there's smart and evil people guiding him inside the administration, just like there was with George W. Bush.
What's funny is like things that they can talk about, they don't. Like Trump said to the president of Mexico, you got to take care of those bad. Basically, it was in regard to building the wall. He was like, you got to take care of those bad hombres down there. I'm going to send the U.S. military to do it for you. And it's all like a posture to try to get them to pay for the wall. And It's interesting. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the only thing that I think Trump is a puppet to isn't even him being a puppet. It's like he has a lot of friends in U.S. energy. If you look at when he does press conferences, he talks about my good friend this, my good friend that. They're all U.S. oil people. I remember I was watching because I didn't really start to pay attention to Trump and think he was funny until I discovered the Can't Stump the Trump YouTube page.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was fucking hilarious, like just because it was well done and funny. And but I would go and I'd watch some of these press conferences. Like I'd see that there's a live press conference. I'd be bored at work and he's in like North Dakota. And who puts it on? Some guy that owns a shale oil company who went from being worth about $7 billion to $2 billion when the price of oil dropped. Mm-hmm. And it was like, yeah, look, that guy has more money than he's in the top 1%, but losing $5 billion has to be a painful thing to go through. And Trump's talks, I mean, if you listen to him, it's interesting. I really do think he's like a U.S. energy guy. And I think that if anybody's pulling his strings, that's who it is. It's U.S. energy. But also, too, like it makes me think about this this obsession. And you only got a few minutes left, man. This is great. I'll have to have you on again. But how we're going. And this is my hope, man. It's like we've been in this globalist culture and now we're going to like a very nationalist idealism. And hopefully we go to like a very state idealism and then like a city state, like just to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And hopefully that's what we focus on, because I feel like that to me is going to be the solution to a lot of things is decentralization, which we're all fans of.
Right.
But I don't know.
I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people who were liberty minded jumped on the Trump wagon.
Trump board, yeah.
Because and you know, it makes sense too, and I don't have a good argument against this, even though I don't like making this argument. I just don't like the way it feels. But if you have a way to go from obviously like self-governance is the ideal. So if you have a way to go from global governance to national governments, you just got closer to self-governance. Now, unless you, as you know, the Germans and so many others did, fall into the trap of complete nationalism, blind nationalism, xenophobia, and otherism, which is only going to harden the nationalist position, right? But Is there a way? So now that the referendum on globalism versus nationalism is over and it went towards nationalism, now we see states like California saying, no, you know what? No nationalism. We're going back to the state, or at least there's some talk about it, and there will probably be other movements like that with other states. I think that could be a very positive trend.
Yeah, that state realistically needs to break up into like four different states.
Oh, absolutely!
It's so different and so big, and also like they're going to have a mass exodus out of California because I've covered this a lot with my good friend Charles Hugh Smith, who he lives in Berkeley, and because there's like everybody's moving to the Bay Area because they think they're going to be a tech billionaire. Everyone's moving to the L.A. area because they think they're going to be an artist that gets paid professionally. And there's so many people there. There's not enough housing. So housing's super inflated. So you're going to have to move to the Midwest where everybody's leaving. And quite honestly, I don't mind. It makes my shit cheaper. So but hey, man, you got to go. Brett, thanks for coming on. How can people get in touch with you and how can people follow your show and your work? Thank you so much for coming on, too, man. I had a great time talking to you.
My pleasure. The best way to check out what I do is at schoolsucksproject.com. Is there anything you think I should point your audience at specifically? I think we've done a lot of overlapping topics, but
homeschooling.
Yeah.
I think you're a great resource for homeschooling.
Yeah, on my website, there's just like people are new. There's in the main nav bar, there's an option called New Start Here. And you can read a little bit about what we're trying to do. And then there's a great interview of that I did with Tom Woods, or that Tom Woods did with me for a book that he wrote. And you can get most of my attitudes about home education versus schooling. And you can see some of our resources on that page. So that'd be a good place for people to start. And I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has at some point in the future.
And Brett's not going to promote this, but if you do like Brett's show, he does have a way that you can support him. He also has an AV club that you guys can join, and also a Patreon account.
Indeed. Thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate that.
Not a problem. Well, hey, guys, thanks again for listening, and looking forward to bringing you another episode soon.
And I'm going to sit right here until I die.